morning. What up, everybody? My name is Jason Miles, and I'll be your host for another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. And this is our episode with co-founder of Reclaim Idaho, Luke Mayville. We didn't get into this on the show too much, but apparently Luke Mayville is the reason why Dave Griscom is on, or was on, the Michael Brooks show. He introduced Brooks to Griscom. Griscom was a student of Mayville. But Luke Mayville is an Idaho native that is a political organizer. And we wanted to do a show about organizing in red states or flyover country or Trump country, you know, insert pejorative here about people that live in the middle of the country. And I was real stoked to do it because I've followed a little bit of what Luke did in Boise, but I was on a label for a time. Actually, the last label I was with was out of Boise, Idaho. So we did a lot of shows in Boise. We spent a lot of time in Boise. I definitely have a lot of good friends in Boise. Some of the best shows I did were in northern Idaho, in Moscow, Idaho. So I understand to a certain degree the demographic that Luke is working with. And what makes it really interesting is, as Medicaid expansion was having a hard time getting passed in the eight states, I believe, when you look at a state like Missouri that passed Medicaid expansion, it didn't get passed because of the rural votes in Missouri. The Medicaid expansion votes generally came from the larger urban areas. And there's kind of only one real urban area in Idaho, and that's Boise, which is a college town. So, you know, a big part of the population doesn't live there. They're not, you know, residents, so to speak. So the fact that they got the expansion passed, and not just passed, but got a majority Republican state legislature to not try to, like, cut the funding last minute or push back last minute, because they had the rural population. He was organizing in these rural areas where generally you're not going to get the vote. But also, if you look at the numbers, especially when it comes to the Medicaid expansion, these rural areas are where hospitals are closing. So we talked about briefly, we didn't spend too much time on it, something that is a conversation that's becoming a little too pervasive in this leftist online space, and that is the idea of some sort of red-brown alliance or some need to work with more extreme radical forces. And you're going to hear Luke say this. And if you're not already a YouTube subscriber, we cut a clip of this because this is, you know, such an important talking point. You know, people are making, I don't want to say careers, but they're making a good amount of money. I mean, you know, reiterating ad nauseum, it's only about a class war. Doesn't matter if they're Nazis, it's all about a class war. And when I bring this up to Mayville, because again, I spent a lot of time in northern Idaho, which is known as a bastion of white supremacist and malicious. And he says something, and I'm paraphrasing, I'm not exactly quoting. He's like, look, if you're already politicized and you're radicalized, you're not really the type of person we're trying to talk to, because you're not going to listen to us anyway. But even if you may hold some right-wing beliefs, we think we can get to you on the issues. Because one thing that he talks about is the majority of the people that he's talking to in these cities are Republican. In the state of Idaho, a Democrat hasn't won that state, I think he said, in like 40 years. FDR was the last Democratic presidential winner to win Idaho. And they haven't had a Democratic governor, I want to say, like 30, 40 years. So we're talking a hardcore red state. Passing Medicaid expansion in the part of the state where generally people just vote it down. And, you know, we definitely get into what organizing really means, what grassroots really means. So this is a great conversation. I thank you again, Jean, for hooking it up. Pascal Robert came with the questions. Thank you, Luke Mayville, for agreeing to come on. Hopefully we'll have you on again. There's so much more we want to talk about. So if you're not a patron, you want to hear the bonus half of this discussion. Luke says he's going to stay in for like a couple minutes. He did not. He stayed for another hour. Patreon.com/Bitterleg Presents. YouTube.com/This Is Revolution Podcast, and that is my cue. Thank you guys so much. If you haven't done it, like, subscribe, leave a comment, share, write a review, and I am out. Hello, hello. Hope I didn't shock too many people with that opening photo. But, you know, I try to have these backdrops for the show while you guys are waiting for the introduction. And I saw that and I couldn't resist. But before we get to today's topic, I would like everyone to like and subscribe, hit the bell and leave a comment. As you already know, we do read the comments. Also, we've been pretty active in the Discord. So if you are a patron, Pascal and I will be popping in, more so Pascal than me. And speaking of Pascal Robert, let's bring in Pascal Robert. Not a fan of Afro-pessimism. Coming all the way live from Miami, Florida, he is the Pascal Robert.
Peace and greetings to the chat. Peace and greetings to the audience. Peace and greetings, Jason Miles. Yeah. My girl wants to know it's in the room.
Stop it. Stuck in my head. Pascal's been singing the Maoist in the Room song, and it's stuck in me and Jean Bajelon's head. I'm going to be walking around singing that. We'll see if our guest sings that. So before we bring in our guest, we made a video to explain what we're going to talk about today. If you haven't seen that video, here's your chance to watch it now.
The business of our nation goes forward. These United States are confronted with an economic affliction of great proportions. We suffer from the longest and one of the worst sustained inflations in our national history. It distorts our economic decisions, penalizes thrift, and crushes the struggling young and the fixed income elderly alike. It threatens to shatter the lives of millions of our people. Idle industries have cast workers into unemployment, human misery, and personal indignity. Those who do work are denied a fair return for their labor by a tax system which penalizes successful achievement and keeps us from maintaining full productivity.
Under Idaho law, citizens can get an initiative on the ballot for a vote if they can get signatures from 6% of eligible voters statewide. As a part of that total, campaigns need signatures from 6% of voters in 18 of Idaho's 35 legislative districts. New legislation, Senate Bill 1110, aims to change that second requirement to getting 6% of voters in all 35 districts, not just 18.
In the narrative of liberal America, the states of flyover country are often portrayed as bastions of reactionary politics, in which any form of progressive struggle is ultimately futile. Such a narrative serves to reinforce a sense of smug cultural superiority on the part of some upper-class liberals. Indeed, the notion that reform and change in the rural Midwest is impossible often provides the Democratic Party with a rationale for the abandonment of these territories to Republican control. However, the reality of politics in rural America is far more complex than many assume. This week, we talked to Luke Mayville, the co-founder of Reclaim Idaho, about both the opportunities and pitfalls facing those seeking to engender progressive reform in the heart of, quote, Trump country. We'll discuss these things and more. This is Revolution.
Medicaid expansion would have made it on the ballot under these proposed rules.
Luke Mayville is co-founder of Reclaim Idaho, the grassroots group that gathered thousands of signatures across Idaho to get Medicaid expansion on the ballot in 2018. Mayville says the current standards, which have been in place for the last 8 years, are already very tough. In those 8 years, 15 initiatives have been proposed and only two have made it on the ballot.
I think that's absolutely true. What the legislature is trying to do is to make it almost impossible to qualify either an initiative or a referendum on the ballot.
I respectfully disagree.
Representative Jim Attis is carrying Senate Bill 1110 with Senator Steve Vick. Attis says the idea is about inclusion of all Idaho counties, not taking power from the people.
What it does is serve to have all of the districts in Idaho participate in the gathering of signatures to be able to put an initiative on the ballot. From my perspective, again, I'm a glass half full kind of guy. I'm trying to make sure that we have all corners of Idaho represented, especially with the demographic shifts we're seeing around the country to more urbanized areas.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
I believe there's a picture of my daughter and I actually in front of that sign on tour in 2016. So without any further ado, he is the co-founder of Reclaim Idaho. This is going to be, I'm very interested, and I shouldn't say interested, I'm very excited to have him tell this story on how they got the Medicaid expansion passed in Idaho. In the rural sections of Idaho, majority of the state, outside of Boise, pretty rural. He is Luke Mayville.
Good to be with you all. Jason Pascal, how are you doing?
Doing all right, brother. Glad to have you on This Is Revolution podcast.
I'm excited because the last label I was with was based out of Boise, and I spent a good amount of time in Boise, Idaho, and Pocatello and Twin Falls, Coeur d'Alene, you name it. If there was a venue in that state, I probably played it at some point in time. So I do have an understanding of the demographics in Idaho. And you are from Sandpoint, correct?
Yes, I moved to that area when I was about 7 years old and grew up there all the way through elementary, middle school, high school. And through this political work, ended up moving back there for a time, and now I live in Boise.
I will say my favorite shows were always in Moscow, Idaho.
That's the college town.
Yeah.
So that's I was there about 3 days ago. Good little town.
It is. It is. So how, and this is the question, I'm sure you get asked this all the time. In reading your op-eds and the stories about your organization, Reclaim Idaho, one of the things that you did was you mobilized rural Idaho, not just the major metropolitan areas.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. When we put Medicaid expansion on the ballot, it's not universal health care, it's not Medicare for all, but it's a really good program that covers a lot of people with reliable health care, including, you know, the group, you know, a lot of the people who need it most, working people who can't afford health care. We organized around that issue. We ended up putting it on the ballot and getting 61% of the vote. Mm-hmm. And the most surprising thing, and really the most gratifying thing, is that we didn't just win in the main city or the other small cities. We won the majority of the vote in almost every single county, including the five most rural counties. And we only actually lost in the majority of the vote in 9 out of 45 counties. So we built, we talked more about this, but yeah, we mobilized people. We organized, we built teams of volunteers led by local leaders in the community, who went out, knocked on doors, advocated for the issue, and won a lot of support.
And it's not just people knocking on doors. I'm assuming from what I was reading, it sounded like you were getting people literally from the area. So it wasn't just, you know, some students from Moscow or Boise going to places like Sandpoint or Twin Falls or, well, Pocatello is kind of a college town, but, you know, some of the smaller cities in Idaho, you were getting people in these smaller cities. Now, one of the things that you bring up is that in places like Missouri, the only reason why Medicaid expansion passed there is because you have those, you know, two major cities, St. Louis and Kansas City, where the majority of the population is. I don't think a lot of people understand in the West, the majority of the populations are in the major cities. Oregon, they're all in Portland. Washington, the majority of them are in Seattle. Idaho, of course, everybody's in in Boise. And you kind of have these little sparse spots, sprinkles of people that a lot of times don't really get too many out of towners, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that was different for us in Idaho is that we had a lot of pressure early on to go out to the rural communities because for a couple different reasons, but one is because even Boise doesn't make up the majority of the population. It makes up maybe like a quarter. And even then, the county that Boise's in, which is the most urban county, it's not even Democratic. It's actually a Republican county still. So a Democrat hasn't, what my understanding is, a Democrat hasn't won the most populous county in Idaho. The Democrat, a Democrat hasn't won since FDR, that county.
Yes.
So it's actually still, it's contested at the local level. So we've had some good candidates run, who are a little more left-leaning, who've managed to win countywide, but never a presidential candidate. You know, Biden didn't win it. Obama didn't win it. So we couldn't even rely on that county. If we couldn't pursue the strategy that other states have pursued of just trying to win something like Medicaid expansion in the most urban parts, we really had to get out there. So from the very beginning, yeah, Jason, it's like you said, we didn't just like pack a bunch of people, you know, on tour and go knock doors in rural places. We really went on tour all around the state, but it was always an organizing tour. It wasn't just kind of knocking on doors. It was us trying to find potential leaders and then challenge them to lead in their own communities and then really do what we could, which is what I think of as that's classic community organizing, is actually finding and doing what you can to develop leaders from within communities. And that's what we managed to do by the end of the campaign, probably close to 20 counties. We had some kind of local leadership, some kind of local community involvement of people actually going out and knocking on doors themselves. And that's what made our campaign somewhat distinct from, say, other states that have done similar kind of ballot initiatives. And it really was a major part of our success.
Now, I do have to add, before I pass it off to Pascal, then I'll shut up. I do want to ask, why do you think people in these, and of course not where you were in Idaho, why do people in places like Missouri, let's say, vote against these Medicaid expansions? Is it just right-wing talking points about increased taxes? What is it?
Well, sometimes what it is, this is my hunch at least, there's really a messaging war where, you know, the pro-Medicaid expansion campaign is putting out one set of messaging, the opposition putting out another set of messaging. And the problem is, in a lot of rural communities, the only message someone will get for healthcare, for Medicaid expansion, is just an occasional TV ad. Or maybe even they'll get bombarded with the exact same TV ad like 100 times. Yeah. But that's the only voice they get. They don't get, you know, someone local on the local radio advocating for it. They don't get, you know, someone necessarily, you know, coming through the internet who they're familiar with advocating for it. And they definitely don't often get, you know, someone knocking on their door and talking to them about it face to face. And it really comes down to a very unbalanced media environment where the right just absolutely dominates the media environment. So the only way to actually push in the other direction is to have a very different kind of campaign where you don't just, you know, get at people kind of from the, you know, from the air waves through TV ads. You probably should do that to be, you know, responsible, but you've also really got to get out there face to face. You've got to build up support within the community. You've got to organize. That's fundamental to really, you know, winning these types of campaigns.
Are you going to churches?
Well, somewhat. That wasn't a core part of our organizing strategy. We did some of that. it really varied. We kind of experimented with some different things early on, but we never settled on like one community, like the church that we were gonna, you know, go in every town. It kind of varied by town based on what oftentimes is based on what local leaders and community members thought would be a good strategy. There was a lot of variety that could very well be a good tactic in the future. And we're organizing around a new campaign now. So we're always looking for new promising tactics.
And just so people know, there are parts of Idaho where the speed limit is 80 miles an hour.
That's true. And it's really difficult. One of our, core tactics that we're probably most known for is that we toured around the state in a bright green camper. Originally it was a 1978 Dodge Ranger that we spray painted bright green, and we put the slogan "Medicaid for Idaho" across the side of it.
Mm-hmm.
And we drove that all around, and it was pretty tough when you're on those 80 mile an hour interstates to keep up with the traffic in that
thing. I can only imagine. I think that thing tops out at like 65, 70.
Yeah, that's about it. And then if you get going too fast, one little gust of wind will basically almost knock you over. It's like you're driving down the interstate in a giant sail where you just get buffeted by the wind back and forth.
Trust me. I've done 60 down those highways too in some vans that I had no business
driving. Yep.
Go for it, Pascal.
Luke, I'm very glad to have you here because, we've had a decent number of organizers on our program in the past, but one of the consistent conversations we've been having as of late is the inability, or maybe the word is unwillingness of the contemporary left to take the necessity of organizing in the spaces of working class Americans seriously enough to translate into actual wins. We focus on particularly the Black community through the vis-a-vis the Black church, neighborhood coalitions, and so on and so forth. In reading some of the articles you've written and listening to some of the articles you've done, one of the things that I found impressive about the victory that you were able to have in Idaho is that you don't take it over the top and say, this is the strategy for the left to win over in Trump country. You've never made that prognostication. You've never said, this is the way we're going to win it. Do it the way we did it at all. What you did say is that you found this tactic particularly helpful compared to the normal and normative organizing strategies. And in one of the interviews that I heard you said something that was very fascinating to me. One, you distinguish your organizing tactics, which I'd like you to elaborate on, which is actually taking people from the communities and giving them leadership roles in organizing movements and have them lead, speak on the talking points and lead on the knocking on the doors and put them in positions of power. I found that very fascinating. But secondly, you said that part of the problems you found with the traditional organizing within the progressive, more party-oriented acolytes was that they had a very almost corporate, top-down, managerial approach to how they organize. I found that distinction very fascinating, and I'd like you to really elaborate on that for our audience, if you can do that, please.
Yeah, that's been fundamental. The tendency that we're pushing back against is a tendency of a lot of political groups across the spectrum, but definitely including progressive groups, to really organize in I think what you could describe as a managerial corporate way, where you have the base of your organization in the main city, the capital city. So for national groups, it will be based in, DC or New York. In state-based groups, it will often be based in either the state capital or the major city. and you have, you know, maybe thousands or millions of, you know, members who are part of your organization, but you don't really ask much of them. You don't really demand much of them or challenge them to do much beyond very easy lifts, very, you know, very low effort actions, things like at the very most make a phone call or, you know, join some kind of phone bank. But more often it's, you know, just chip in a couple dollars or send an email. And, oh, by the way, it's really easy because we've already made this email tool for you. And all you have to do is like click two buttons and maybe type in a sentence. What we do, which is a more traditional, I really think of it as a more democratic as opposed to managerial mode of operating, is that you have to actually go out there and challenge people to do hard things. And a core principle that underlies, you know, our willingness to do that, to go challenge people, is this belief that there are people out there spread all across the country in every kind of community, and, you know, including the communities that might seem least receptive, or, you know, most like with most hopeless, or however you want to put it. In every community, there are people who want to do big things. They want to really devote themselves to something and be part of something big and achieving something that will lift up their community, that will help thousands or millions of people. And the role of an organizer on a mass scale is to figure out strategically, how do you find those people? How do you get to them? How do you put that challenge in front of them? And then along the way, how do you inspire them with confidence, and then give them as much as you can, give them the tools, the training, whatever resources they need to actually get in the fight and do that work. And so that's what we've found is, you know, really fires people up. It's been a great success to not just claim to be this small group of leaders who are fighting for people, but instead actually go out into communities and try to equip people to fight for themselves. That's been a basic principle of our operation.
What I find appealing of that paradigm for me personally, as a student of political history, is that it reckons me back to the Ella Baker Snick model of organizing that was used with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, in that they actually would empower people, common folk like Fannie Lou Hamer, to actually take leadership positions in the organizational superstructure and the development of the movement in organizing people in their communities to engage in their determining their political futures. Do you think that kind of strategy could be effective? Maybe not so much as churning these localities blue for the Democrats, as if we're really eventually interested in that per se. Maybe we are, maybe we are not. But in developing issue by issue policies that are transformative, rooted in the political economy of working class folk in those communities, where they can actually have more socialist friendly policy agendas, progressive, if you want to use that word, which I think is kind of weak, or socialist friendly kind of policy objectives that deal with their economic politics. In other words, does this type of organizing open a potential door for an effective class politics in even these traditionally conservative regions?
Absolutely. I'm glad you brought up Ella Baker, because the political theory underlying her work, as I understand it, and I only really started reading much about it kind of recently, but it's very much, I see it as very much aligned with what we're trying to do. It's a, you know, if I understand her correctly and what she was so concerned about. She was very skeptical of the kind of charismatic leadership model. And not that you don't need charisma and some amount of, you know, leadership at the higher levels to inspire people. But there's something missing if you're not actually trying to cultivate, you know, something like charismatic leader, you know, leadership in every county, right? If you're going out there trying to actually build up local leaders, and that's how you can get more durable change. But to your larger question, what we found, say, if you're talking about, you know, trying to get localities or communities to vote Democratic, we've found that that's not a very helpful way to think about our mission or not, and our strategy, because part of our success, a big part of our success, is that we're not asking people to label themselves in partisan terms and go out into their communities with this label that has been so thoroughly, you know, branded in a negative way, that has been so thoroughly tainted all across rural America. You know, we work with people who consider themselves Democrats, some people who don't, there are some people even who are Republicans. But one common theme that we've seen when we go to communities is for those who do consider themselves Democrats, they're terrified of going out into their community and, you know, trying to organize around the Democratic Party, because that's just not it. There, people in their communities have such dug in preconceived ideas about what it is to be a Democrat. But the real breakthrough we found is if you go into a community and you say, "Hey, whoa, we're not challenging you to go win votes for Democrats or to advocate for the Democratic Party. We're challenging you to go out to your neighbors and try to get more funding for the local school district, so that your best teachers in your district are less likely to leave to Washington State, where they pay $20,000 more per year to be a teacher." Or, you know, we're challenging you to go out into your community and try to secure healthcare coverage with federal dollars that are already available, and that will cover 2,000 working people in this county. Can you go out to your neighbors and talk about that? And people find that, oh yeah, I'm more than happy to talk about that, because, you know, I know that my neighbors care about that. Even if we get into these bitter disagreements and fights on social media when it comes to, you know, Trump, Biden, Bernie, whatever, if you make it about, and this gets back, Pascal, to your point about, you know, class politics and economics, if you get back to the bread and butter issues that are so important for their day-to-day quality of life, that's what can really empower people to feel confident going out into their community and trying to persuade people to think differently and to you know, come together and you know, organize around different types of issues.
Now, how do you get around? I did a show early on when I started doing this. A woman was running for Senate in Wyoming. You know, similar makeup to where you're from. Yeah. I think it's even more sparse. I think it's even more sparsely populated than even where you're from in Idaho. And she ran as an open socialist. And, you know, you're going to get a lot of pushback when you say words like that in such a red state, right? But when I was doing my pre-show research on her, there were some radio shows she was on. And no matter what issue that she brought up, it was always a partisan issue, and she was always going to be on the wrong side of it.
Yeah.
So how do you keep these? So the thing that you're fighting for now is an increase in the budget for the public schools. How do you keep this from being a partisan issue?
Well, what we're finding is it doesn't even, the natural tendency of it is to not be a partisan issue. Mm-hmm. Like the right and, you know, our opponents have to do a lot of work to try to turn public schools into a partisan issue, because and I bet you this is true all across the country. When you just survey people or poll people about public education, they don't see public education as a partisan thing. They see public education as like something that their families deserve, and that, you know, it is the role of government to provide public education. And if anything, they kind of scratch their heads when, you know, right-wing ideologues come around trying to make some kind of argument that, you know, public education should be replaced by some kind of business model. And I'll give you an example. In Idaho, in 2012, a really ambitious elected Republican came in. He was the superintendent of public instruction, which is something like the, you know, statewide secretary of education. Mm-hmm. His name was Tom Luna. He was one of these really dedicated, like, education reformers who wanted to privatize all kinds of aspects of public schools, who wanted to shift a whole lot of the learning from teaching to computerized things.
Wow.
He wanted to dismantle collective bargaining for teachers.
He wanted to get rid of the unions, right?
Yeah. That was back in 2012. He pushed through the legislature a series of three laws that did all those things. Mm. The people of Idaho rose up together with the actual teachers union. Mm-hmm. And the teachers union got like won over the mass, you know, of the vast majority of the electorate to their side, built this movement, they put up a referendum and put directly to the voters the opportunity to strike down all three laws. Mm-hmm. And they were struck down overwhelmingly. And by far the most unpopular one was the idea of replacing teachers with computers. But just in general, the collective bargaining one got struck down. The anti-collective bargaining one got struck down. And what became apparent through that campaign was that when you go out and really just advocate for, you know, protecting, strengthening public schools, you're on really fertile ground. Like, there's people out there who want to see their schools stronger. That's the majority of people, even in a deep red state. But this is a big part of it. And maybe this goes back to Pascal's question too. There's this kind of low-hanging fruit of these bread and butter issues that in most people's minds don't fall clearly on the left or the right or on the Republican Democrat spectrum. They're just like deeply rooted values that people have. Mm-hmm. And they're just there. And if you go up to the average person and you try to make them political or Democrat or make them partisan, people are just kind of confused. They're like, no, schools are good. I want my, teachers should get paid. I want my kid to have a good teacher. So you got to pay the teacher, you know? And healthcare is similar. You know, that you could come up with other issues that are similar, but like another issue that's similar in Idaho that we haven't organized around, but we did put on our original banner of things that we were interested in organizing around is public lands. So like access, which I kind of think of as like access to natural beauty, you know, like that's not partisan. But it is something that cuts directly against the grain of right-wing ideology, right? The idea that you would just have some of the most beautiful, pristine lands in the country owned by the public, and that you wouldn't open them up for business, and you wouldn't sell them, that you would protect them And similarly, you know, it's a really similar thing with the public school system. Public schools are, people take for granted that public schools are a great thing, but public school itself cuts directly against, you know, right-wing ideology, right? Like the whole institution is like completely contradicted, you know, by right-wing ideology. And so that's a real, those facts that I just laid out are very promising for those of us who want to organize around these things, because the people, we start out with the people on our side. Like, we don't, to your original question, we don't have to win over the people. We actually start with the people on our side. And what we have to do is then, you know, organize, mobilize popular will to actually protect these things, to strengthen these things. And that's what we're doing.
I have a question I'd like to, and this is, you know, perhaps provocative. What do you make of the allegations by the more corporate neoliberal faction of the Democratic Party by using, I think, rather horrible appellations such as deplorables or the people who are, quote unquote, you know, beyond redemption for their unwillingness to become voters in the Democratic coalition under the auspices of some of the more recent candidates they've had for president, whether they be Joe Biden or Hillary Clinton, and the way in which, to be absolutely candid, that voters in these, I don't like to use the word flyover country, but let's use that term, are just deemed to be straight out reactionary white racists who are beyond redemption and quite frankly should be ostracized and just, you know, relegated to the dustbin of American political history because, you know, they're nothing but a bunch of folks who just want to lynch black people and burn Jews down, if you will. Not to say that there may not be elements of that quote, people like that who are in the Trump camp, but what is your position to those who make those arguments or those who will say that even trying to do as you do, organize in these in spaces, and I would never accuse that all the people in those spaces as being some type of crypto Nazis if at all, but who make the argument that you are actually pushing some type of red brown alliance Nazball type politics. I'd like to hear your retort, Luke.
Well, I mean, it's just not the case that people, you know, it's just not the case in my experience that people are irredeemable, at least when you're talking about large numbers of people, at least when you're talking about the majority of your fellow citizens. I mean, I don't like to, I mean, I'm, you know, personally, I'm of the worldview that people are redeemable, you know, in a basic sense. So, but that's just my kind of spirituality. But politically, I've just had thousands of conversations face to face with people where, you know, people will have some views that, sure, I find their view deplorable on one thing. But I can bring them around and I might be able to start a conversation with them on that thing where at least I get them to think a little differently about it, you know, say on, you know, racism, white identity politics type stuff. Like I might be able to challenge them on that thing and at least get them thinking a little differently. But at the same time, as part of that same conversation, even if I didn't change their mind completely, I can actually build common ground on these bread and butter economic issues. And I suppose someone could criticize me and say, you know, no, as long as they hold those deplorable views on that one thing, you shouldn't even deal with them at all. You shouldn't even try to get their vote for healthcare or for public schools. For me, that's just not acceptable because that would mean giving up on the public education system. That would mean giving up on healthcare for working people. That would mean giving up on trying to maintain some collective capacity to actually do good things together and preserve some of the things that are most precious to me, right? So I think it's easier to have that. It's easier to have the opposite view, that you can just give up on people, that if people don't come around on some basic issues of, you know, human dignity and equality, then you have to consider them irredeemable. It's easier to have that view if you don't have to share an immediate political community with them. Like maybe if you're in a deep blue state and you consider yourself like kind of safe from that, where people more of your persuasion dominate, and you know, you can just kind of let that go, let those people be over there and forget about them. Even then though, I don't think it's really that way of thinking really holds up, because if you're talking about America, at least you're still in America and they can still win the presidency and they can still win Congress.
But would you agree though, that there's a difference between a Republican that may be extremely conservative and a Nazi? A Nazi doesn't give a shit about healthcare or public schools. They don't want to align with you. They don't care to. They're a Nazi.
I think, that's true. But in my experience, if you were to draw that kind of distinction, then you're talking about a very tiny group of people. Like even in Idaho, you're talking about like actual, you know, extremists in, not just in that they hold some extreme views, but that they're like committed to some kind of, you know,
to stay off my land. And you know who I'm talking about.
Yeah. And there are, I mean, what I found to be the reality in some ways is maybe more disturbing, is that there's actually a much larger group of people who hold bits and pieces of those views. Right.
Yeah.
And that's hard. And I think that's gets to Pascal's question, it is something of a moral dilemma when you're trying to, you know, you're like the attempt to build common ground with people who just deny basic, you know, human dignity and moral principles that we hold dear is a morally fraught thing. But ultimately in many cases, I don't think we really have much of an option if we want to, you know, have a public school system, you know, like if we want to have some basic standards of economic, you know, prosperity and decency, there's no way to do that without building collective political will, including with people who have some abominable views.
I would say to kind of even push back a little on you, Pascal, is that there's just a extreme difference between, especially in places like Idaho, where there are parts of Idaho, Luke, stop me if I'm lying, where Luke would tell me, Jay, don't go there. You're not knocking on that door.
I think that's true. I think, I'm not actually sure I would say that. I think I would say, I mean, as someone who's very familiar with some of the places that some others would describe that way, mm-hmm. I think if I'm being honest, I would say like, don't go up that driveway. Like I wouldn't say like, don't even go to that. I wouldn't say don't even go to that town. You know what I mean? I would say, oh, keep away from that part of that, you know.
But we agree that there's just, you're not going to reach everyone. And there's some people that are going to be beyond reproach. But I think there's this thing where especially in this sphere that we're in here in this leftist podcast world, that people act as if you can just go up to Klan people and Nazis and Proud Boys and tell them, hey, fucking public goods governance. Don't you just love it? Isn't it going to make everybody better and kumbaya? Like,
no, it's not that. And usually, and I think part of the, you know, part of the debate is like, I think when people, you know, get naive about it is when they think that you can go like directly to a highly politicized person who's an extremist and like build some kind of alliance with them. What I'm talking about that is that where there is more promise is ordinary people who aren't all necessarily all that politicized, but they've had dumped on them, you know, they've a whole lot of propaganda. And that is an important distinction. There's a distinction between people who are actively a part of politics and they're actually organizing around far right extremism and things. And then there's people who are just going about their lives trying to make a living and trying to, you know, make ends meet. And they've had some extremist propaganda that they've kind of swallowed up. So you can reach ordinary people, in my experience, much more effectively because they've also soaked up just through their daily life, you know, some good ideas and some values that we share, that I share. And that's where you can find common ground with people.
Well, let's make this clear. I didn't ask the question because I agree with that position. I'll be very candid about what my position is relative to that accusation by liberals and neoliberals, particularly, is that they make that accusation and they make those statements about deplorables and irredeemable because they use it to mask the fact that their politics have been designed to damage those people for over 40 years. It's intentionally done to alienate a constituency that their politics has been intentionally created to throw under the bus and use the charade of we don't like the racists to get black people who they also throw under the bus to believe that somehow they're immune to racist policy, which is a lie. Mm-hmm. Because they've been more willing to coalesce around NAFTA, around GATT, around a financial deregulation causing subprime mortgage crises, around mass incarceration, around welfare abolition. So this con game that the neoliberals play, your Hillarys, like, you know, even some of your K-Hive Biden folks about like, oh, they're the deplorables, the white working class, this is that, is because they know that for since the rise of DLC Clintonism and even going back to Jimmy Carter, they've been sticking the shiv in working class black and white people, but they use this, oh, the white working class are so racist. Trust us who made sure your grandmother couldn't get any welfare and made sure that your nephew was locked up for 25 years for having a dime bag of crack cocaine. So they play this con game intentionally. I don't trust Democrats or Republicans, but the large part is that because the Democrats will play that con game, they're allowed to get off as acting as if they have some kind of racial high ground over the quote-unquote reactionaries they try to depict, when in reality, their policies have been more, even as, if not more racist than anyone else in this country.
Well, I'll tell you where I have seen something like this kind of dialogue happen within Idaho. I wouldn't say I've seen like Democrats or like party leaders or active Democratic leaders, elected officials. They're not usually dismissing, you know, white working class voters or rural voters as irredeemable and things, because the political reality is just such that would just be a path to powerlessness in Idaho, because if you can't win over some of those voters, you don't have a shot. It's much more common from what I've seen to see that kind of dismissive view come out of like other states who are looking at places like Idaho and they're like, no, forget it, forget them. But where you do see something like that here in Idaho is you'll talk to people in a more liberal part of the state and, you know, we'll talk about what I've been doing or what our organization's been doing. And they'll kind of look at you really wide eyed, like, you're going to go to that part of the state, you're going to go to that county. Mm-hmm. You know, that's pretty hopeless. And, And not only that, like, there is sometimes a little bit of that sense that these people are just unreachable, and there's just such a big chasm. And that's part of what we're trying to do as an organization. That's part of the idea of Reclaim Idaho, is for all of us to actually have more of a belief in ordinary people everywhere, you know, like all over our state. So, like, I'm always pushing back, and other people in our organization are too. Whenever someone says, like, oh, don't go to that, that county's different. Like, that county's too infected with, you know, that kind of ideology. They're not going to support our initiative. And we're always saying, no, like, they're every, like, I mean, this is a little bit of an exaggeration, but we're like, no, every registered voter, every voting age person, we're going after them. Like, it doesn't matter. And just as a rule of thumb, we're going to approach people. And again, I would draw a line with when it's like active politicized extremists who are, you know, bad actors, right? But when you're talking about the ordinary people who are just, you know, trying to get by, just living their lives, there is no reason to think that they won't support an initiative to get more funding, you know, to restore corporate taxes and get more funding to their public schools. We just spent the whole weekend, this Labor Day weekend, we went to a small town called St. Mary's, a logging town, where they have this huge event every year called Paul Bunyan Days. And they've got a giant statue in their main street downtown of Paul Bunyan. And it's just thousands of people from all over the region are there. And we went person to person getting signatures for this initiative that would increase funding for education by restoring taxes on corporations and by increasing taxes on the wealthiest, highest income earners. We just went one by one, person to person. I think we got like 3 out of 4 people we asked to sign, like, consistently. And even the people who wouldn't sign were more likely to be kind of blown us off because they just didn't want to take the time. we didn't get a lot of ideological pushback on that.
I mean, my goal here is not to fetishize working class white folk or fetishize anyone, black, white, or otherwise. What I'm saying is that basically that the overall reality here is that we have a two-party duopoly that responds to the interests of capital. They both work at the behest of capital. One is not interested in using racial diversity to maintain its hegemonic power and will use otherization to maintain that power, which is the Republicans. One will use the fear of racial reactionaries in the Republican Party as a means to maintain this coalition, and those are the Democrats, while both of them are interested in serving the needs of capital. My interest is to puncture that complete balloon that keeps people wedded to both failed parties and try to create a politics in which working class people, black, white, yellow, otherwise, challenge both of them with working class agendas and politics and policy. And unfortunately, we're at a moment in time in which those people who claim to be quote unquote progressive, whatever that is, or left or socialist, believe that Democratic Party entryism is the best way to do that, or believed that at least up until 2020. And I don't know how well that's particularly worked out for those working class folk. But what does give me hope is that people like yourself who are willing to say that we're willing to talk to anyone. I'm not saying that we should go be talking to Nazis or Proud Boys or Boogaloo Boys or Klansmen. I'm not making that argument at all. But people who are not that ridiculously reactionary and racist, who are willing to understand, listen, your government is not working for you and you pay taxes. How can you make your government work for you and do things that will actually fulfill your needs as a citizen? Yeah. And doing that in a creative way that you guys have done so, frankly, is doing a lot better than these people who are, you know, on these social media platforms talking about how AOC is not using all her power. And I think my question is, how can we get the methodology you've used that have gotten some results, you know, we've seen some actual tangibles come out of this, implemented by the people who are higher ups in this quote-unquote new faction of the left, if you will?
Well, I'll say, I mean, I'll just say something in defense of the initiative process. The initiative process doesn't exist in every state in the country, but it exists in about half of the states. And it's not perfect. In a lot of states, initiatives are sometimes hijacked by big money, and they're used to really push, you know, special interest causes that don't have a lot of grassroots support and things. But in states like Idaho, that are dominated by a Republican political establishment that has not, you know, that has not run the government in a way where it, you know, actually works to meet people's basic needs. In these kinds of states, and where, you know, there's really not many other alternatives, the initiative process is one of the only tools we have to actually achieve policy change. But not only that, something that I want to say in defense of the initiative process everywhere is that initiatives are not just a way to change one law at a time. They're also a very powerful tool for organizing, because you can go into communities and you have a really straightforward challenge to people, like, that's measurable. We need you to get out there, engage your neighbors face to face, and collect signatures. And if done well, it's a really powerful political tool, because in the course of getting signatures, you're also having really important conversations with people about the issues that directly affect their lives. And I can't think, you know, you can't win any kind of long-term political change without those conversations, without that organizing and persuasion. So the initiative process is something that anyone who lives in a state with an initiative should think seriously about. If we didn't have the initiative, what we would probably be doing, which could also, and we've done some of this and we've had some success with this as well, is we would do issue campaigns. We would seize on issues that the majority of people either already are on our side or we really believe could be persuaded to join us. And we would build popular will. We would build majority support for those issues through things like mass town hall events, through things like major, you know, big forums and public events, not just protests where people show up and, you know, chant and things, but I'm not saying that to disparage protests. I think protests can be really important too. But when there's an element of actual engagement, including people being invited who don't even agree with you on things and being pressured to, and being challenged to actually engage around issues, it's not easy, but through that kind of organizing, whether it's through that type of issue-based campaign or through initiative campaigns, you can challenge people in local communities to lead. You can just, you know, increase the number of people by thousands who are actively engaged in the political process. And that's critical, because especially in deep red states, the party system isn't working to get people engaged. I will say, though, one last thing I want to say to your question, Pascal, is, and maybe we just disagree on this, but I don't want to discourage efforts within the Democratic Party to actually shape the Democrat, to remold the Democratic Party around, you know, working people's issues and around bread and butter economic issues where you can build popular support. And we see some of that, including here in Idaho. There are some leaders who are saying, you know, in the Democratic Party who are saying, you know, let's actually mold something like a working families, working people's economic agenda and put that at the center of the Democratic Party. It's not easy because there are pressures to make politics about other things, but I personally encourage that because I think that even though the Democratic Party has a lot of problems, it is still an institution that's out there that does at its best has been effective in certain episodes in our history. And so I'm not giving up on them, even though that's not the main avenue I've chosen to organize through.
Well, Luke, you may not have given up on the Democratic Party, but trust me, brother, they gave up on you a long time ago.
I mean, I feel what you're saying. Like when I grew up in a small town in North Idaho, I grew up in a very conservative environment. I never considered what really drove me and politicized me and got me thinking about, you know, the left and all these different issues was the Iraq War. And I didn't even think back when I got politicized, I didn't even consider becoming a Democrat because the Democrats voted for the war. And you find that a lot in rural communities from what I've seen is people will move to the left, but they'll just skip straight over the Democratic Party because they don't really see that big of a difference between the parties. So I completely understand what you mean. I have seen a difference in Idaho, at least, between, you know, kind of national Democratic strategy, national Democratic rhetoric, and local people who are just well-intentioned and trying to do good things. So I'm not giving up on those people, but I see what you mean.
Well, Luke, we do and I know it's late where you are, we do a bonus patron after hours where we have a slightly more candid conversation behind a paywall. You're more than welcome to join us if you have the time.
All right. I'm happy to jump in for a couple minutes at least.
Okay. Okay. You said nothing but a word. I will send you the link. Thank you guys for joining us. We went a little longer today. Because Pascal wants to ask questions with 5 minutes left. Yep. Looking at you, partner. Looking at you. You were so good while I was gone. And I come back.
Well, Jason, before we go into the other session, mm-hmm. I'm challenging you right now to not make your last to not make your last tour through Idaho your final tour. We want to see you back in Coeur d'Alene.
I want to go back to Boise there, but you know what's sad? I have a poster, and I will leave with this. I have a poster of a little tour we did in 2013, and every venue on that tour is no more. The venue in Boise is gone. A lot of tours. Tiki Bar and Utah is gone. There's so many of these little places that are no more. So I know I don't even know what's left in Boise. Is Neuralux still there?
Well, we'll get you. What we'll do is we'll get you out of Treefort, which is the big.
Yes, Treefort is a huge festival there.
Yeah, we'll get you.
Well, say no more.
There it is.
Because I would love to play Treefort. That's like 30,000 people come out to that.
Yep.
Well, thank you very much, Luke. I will be sending you a link shortly, Pascal.
No problem, comrade.
Mr. I Talk Forever, Pascal. Want to ask questions at the last minute, Pascal?
Oh, here we go, man.
Broke my heart, man.
All right. Thanks, everyone. Stay safe out there.
All right. Peace, guys.